From the guy who's read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, this is a Guy's Take episode. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the Crypto Economy Podcast. I am your host, Guy Swan, and I'm doing a Guy's Take episode today. I had been meaning, and I've been collecting notes on a bunch of, I have a whole list of like little text edit files where I just throw notes and notes and notes into crap that usually gets lost, but I like having them. And I have been planning to do, there's a lot of things that I talk about in the commentary of some of these articles and stuff where I hit some specific topic, in pretty extensive detail, or I'll come up with some analogy or something, or I'll explain some piece of something that's just a section out of that episode. And I've been meaning to take and like isolate these things so that I can point people to specific arguments or specific analogies on a topic that isn't confused or hidden among a conversation about 30 different other things. So that's what we're going to do with, I'm going to start having a number of these Guys Take episodes where I hit one topic specifically and try to explain it as best I can, with an analogy or a little story. And today I want to do the boom and bust cycle. So that's what we're going to jump into. This is an explanation you may have heard on the show. I know I've dropped it in at least one, maybe two episodes, but I had a number of people tell me that it was a very succinct argument and analogy for it that really explains what is happening, or it makes it easy to visualize what the boom and bust cycle is doing and how it is caused. So I want to set that back up and see if we can just do an episode hitting that one topic and hitting that analogy. So before we get into it, I just want to say I had a really, really fun night last night at the Raleigh Bitcoin meetup, and we recorded an episode, actually. This was the first. We kind of did this completely on the fly and didn't really know how it was going to go, and it's kind of funny. We just kind of jumped right into it when we started recording, but we have, what was it, one, two, three? We had like six people basically on the microphones, sitting around, and we just talked all about like privacy, how Bitcoin influenced or kind of changed the nature of privacy, how we saw privacy going in the future, like what were the trends, all kinds of stuff, everything that you could think about for privacy. And we just kind of went at it for like an hour and a half or something like that. So I think when I finally get the audio and get all that pieced together, I think that's going to be a really, really fun episode. And I'd love to get feedback from you guys on how you thought that episode went, because we were planning on trying to do this again and maybe even keeping it up like a monthly thing or something. You know, no promises, because it is a bit of a setup. But I don't know. We had a lot of fun. I personally had a lot of fun on that episode. So hopefully that should be coming pretty soon, so keep an ear out for that one. But with that, let's go ahead and jump into, let's just jump into our story about the boom and bust cycle. Now, this explanation or this analogy in particular, I think does a decent job at three things. Is first, like, what is really happening with the underlying resources? And that's one of the biggest obscurities for any attempt at figuring out what the heck the boom and bust cycle is and why it happens, is that why is there such a disconnect between the actual resources available and the resources that people are basically planning to use? Why is there that disconnect? Isn't the price system there to smooth all that out so that when an imbalance occurs, the price adjusts and the imbalance gets corrected? Because we're talking about an imbalance between supply and demand. Everybody demands too much and you have this huge boom period, and then we find out that we can't actually pay for it. We have this massive bust and prices get cut in half or worse. Like, why would something so drastic, an imbalance so drastic, not show up in the market price? So it's like, what's happening with the real underlying resources? Why is there a boom cycle that is prolonged for such a long period of time? And how exactly is it that price manipulation or the banking system in general, what piece of the banking system or what characteristic of the banking system is making this imbalance worse and prolonging it? And is the bust cycle, is the bust period actually a good or a bad thing? Because we have this idea that what we should do is we should just prolong the boom. We should have just an infinite boom and never have to worry about it. Like, is the bust actually useful? There's a reason why that bust happens, right? So to start off with, like, let's just hit kind of some overall ideas. The economy, like, at large, is just kind of the struggle between planning to consume resources in the future versus consuming them right now. There is so much activity which is just about whether or not we're doing long-term plans or short-term plans, and it is entirely limited, and the price adjusts to account for exactly how many resources we are able to produce at any given time. So, and that's including as a resource the amount of time that we can devote to either producing or consuming a good. Obviously, if everybody decides to stop producing and consuming, decides to stop producing and instead decides they want to consume resources, well, we can only do that for so long before we have to start producing again. There's the struggle in the price system to keep those things balanced. And that's what prices do. They try to allocate high prices to things that are desperately needed or and in low supply, like, you know, supply and demand, the basic idea. So we're trying to allocate real resources over time. And this also includes any decisions or things that we're doing as far as changing or improving the production process. So the idea is that we have to have savings in order to shut down a production process and then improve it or change it or create a new production process. We have to have things to consume now that can get us across the gap for when we have to shut down our production. And so savings is absolutely critical. If we had an economy where everybody was consuming the exact amount that was being produced, then obviously as soon as a hurricane comes through and blows out a building that's producing a shirt, producing shirts or something, or kills a crop, or any kind of just normal, like the wear and tear of machinery, if we don't have any savings, if we're living straight one-to-one, then we immediately have a shortage. Immediately, our production no longer matches our consumption, and somebody's going to starve, or we're all going to have to cut back on how much we eat, and prices are going to go up. So savings is critical to the economy in the sense that we cannot grow or change anything without saved resources to consume. Now, money is not a resource. It's used like a resource or a good because it is a good, but it's not a consumable resource. It is unique among goods. And I had a really long conversation with somebody once trying to get through their head. I don't know if they were just being belligerent because they were having to defend and make it, they just didn't want to be wrong on the internet. I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if that's all it is that I'm arguing with sometimes. But they were trying to argue that money is a consumable good. I'm like, no. Like this, the definition of consumable is something that disappears from existence after it's used. Money is not that. Money can exchange hands hundreds, thousands of times. It is a tradable good, and it is a good in the economy, but it is not consumed. The only way you get value out of money is if you trade someone else for real resources. That's not how you get value out of a sandwich. You eat a sandwich. You eat a chicken. You eat or you consume a gear to put into a machine. Like there are goods that get used for other things, but money is simply a tool to allocate other resources. It's a proxy. It of itself is useless outside of its use as a money. So that's hard for people to get through. It's that, like, money is not actually the price of money adjusts to allocate for what's happening with real resources to respond to what's happening in the economy. But it's not a real resource itself. People think that, oh, we have to get lots and lots of money, and if somebody is saving a ton of money, well, then they've stolen resources from people, and people can't have people can't eat, or people can't have houses because this person is hoarding all the money. No, the money has nothing to do with it. The act of saving money, the act of hoarding money, means that that person has produced real resources into the economy and not consumed it. Like, if somebody has built 20 houses and then saved $1 million profit from building those 20 houses, it means they've given 20 houses worth of resources and not consumed it. The act of saving is the act of giving resources to other people, because money's not a resource. It's just the ability to consume or acquire resources later in life or in time from in the future. But just think about this in, like, any job or anything. When you save money, it means that you're not consuming what you have produced. The easiest way is just to think of it in the number of meals. If you are working at a job where you produce 20 meals a day and you only consume 2, that means you get to save 18 meals worth of money every day. And at the end of however long that you've saved, it's just that that money just shows, it's proof that you produced a surplus for everyone else but yourself. That you only consume 2 sandwiches while you are making 20. You've done a great and good deed for the economy by not consuming the actual important resources, but instead you've taken a tally system. You've allowed yourself to accept notes that you can't eat under essentially the economic promise that you can get those sandwiches back later because you produced them. So That's the job of savings. That's what money is trying to do in the economy. So somebody who has lots of savings, for like legitimate savings, like not like I printed money or I have some sort of political privilege or whatever it is, and therefore I got rich off the backs of other people, or they stole it or something like that. I mean, if they have earned and traded goods within the economy and produced, and then they have money, it means that they are not consuming what they are producing. They're making a giant surplus for everyone else to consume and just not consuming it for themselves. They're just not taking up those resources. They're producing 80 shirts and just wearing one. Like, that's what a saver is doing. If, of course, they're in the shirt-making business. So because of this, as soon as we start looking at charts of how much money there is or what the price of this, that, or the other is, or we're trying to figure out, money is actually just confusing the situation. That's why when you read all these financial books on, like, the boom and bust cycle, it seems like this overly complicated, like, really wordy thing about what should be a simple imbalance. Why are we consuming all these resources that we really don't have? And that's what's happening, is in the boom and bust cycle, we are essentially, like, if we boom for 10 years and then bust for 2 years, what is essentially occurring is that we are all planning to consume a vast amount of resources, and we are all competing to be, like, in order to consume all of these resources, we're all trying to be the first, essentially, to acquire them all when people start spending them. And then when the bust comes, we find out that there aren't enough resources for all the plans that we made. So this is where our little story comes in. Since all this hinges on the banks and allocating resources that don't exist, let's start with an analogy for the bank using real resources. Instead of putting money in the bank, let's think about it in real resources. And what fractional reserve banking is, as far as real resources go, and what it means to plan to spend resources that don't actually exist. And that's where I love the car analogy specifically, is think of the bank as a giant garage where a bunch of people choose to store their cars. It's like a giant parking garage, and everybody goes and they store their car at the bank so the bank can keep the car safe. And when the customer wants to use the car later, they go to the bank and they say, "I want to get my car out of the bank." And then they, go to work, or they go on a trip, or, whatever it is that they're trying to do. And the bank simply gives them their car. But in the meantime, how do we ensure that, you have the ability to get your car back? You get a note. You get a ticket that says, "I have one car in this bank." And let's say that the cars are ubiquitous. Everybody's got a drives the same boring gray car. Like, all cars are fungible here. And any car that you get out will serve any purpose you need to move or get around. So what is fractional reserve banking in that context? Fractional reserve banking is the bank making the bet that they can get away. Think about it, a ticket for a car is worth a whole car. So, like, I don't need to sell the value of my car that's in the bank. I can just give somebody the paper note, right? Because the paper note's supposed to allow them to go get the car out of the bank. So, like, rather than having to go get the car, drive it to who, let's say I want to buy the new Mac Pro. Well, it's worth about a car, particularly if you get the monitor and the stand, $1,000 stand. So you're trying to buy that thing. Like, there's no reason to go get your car and then barter for the car. Why don't you just give them the note, and then they can get the car out of the bank whenever they want to get it? So that's how we're exchanging the resource without having to actually move it. But the bank is betting on the fact, like, the idea of fractional reserve is that not everybody's going to want to get the car out of the bank at the exact same time. Some people go to work on the weekdays. Some people go to work on the weekends. There's a lot of time that those cars are just sitting in driveways or garages and not being used. But someone has a ticket for the car. So at any time, technically, everyone could need their car all at once. So the bank essentially commits fraud. They start selling these notes that are worth the same, the supposedly worth one full car, that they don't have to have a car in reserve. So now, instead of just charging like a tiny fee to park the garage, they're selling whole cars that they don't even own. So fractional reserve banking, let's say it's subdued. What actually happens in the fractional reserve system is that a bank would actually issue roughly 9 times as many notes to the number of actual cars that there are, after it, like, circulates among different banks. But we'll be nice and say it's a really subdued version of the fractional reserve system. And what they do is they issue twice as many notes as there are cars in the bank. And they get away with it for a while because people obviously don't always need their cars at once. But we're going to stop right here for just a second. And just let that sit. We have a bank where everybody is parking their cars, and the bank is issuing, it gives you a note so that you can get your car out of the bank, and they have started issuing notes that they've started issuing a lot more notes, roughly twice as many as there are actual cars in the bank. So we will come back on that note, and hit our little story about the boom and bust cycle. All right, so now we have 200 people who have notes that, or who have tickets that supposedly tell them they can get a car, but we've only got 100 cars in the bank. Now starts the boom cycle. What we think is that we have all of these resources that we can utilize in the future, so people start to make plans. Let's say all 200 of these people want to go on vacation, and in a couple of years, they're all making their plans, and what kind of plans do we make on vacation? We go to concerts, we go to events, we rent houses or like a beach cottage. We rent spaces to park our cars. We go parasailing. We get tickets for climbing the mountains or hiking up the mountain or going on a gondola or something like that. We make all these plans for consuming other resources in the economy. And we all have to drive to get to those locations. That's what everybody's doing. We're assuming in our little economy, our microeconomy, to make sense of this, we're assuming there's no other form of travel because we're talking about resources. Obviously, that resources come in a million different shapes and sizes, but the idea is that we are planning to consume the resources that we actually have versus resources that are imaginary. So all these people make these plans. They really want to go on these vacations. They've been working their butts off. They've got their car in the bank, which they all earned their car ticket. Sometimes the person actually had the car. Sometimes they just, you know, bought the ticket from someone else, or they bought the ticket from the bank. And the bank made 100 cars worth of, money because people think they're going to be able to get their car out. They're going to be able to drive somewhere that they want to drive at a future date. And these people have worked their butts off. They've saved this capital in order to do this. But then they start making plans. They buy event tickets, and they plan to go to restaurants and go out to eat. They set reservations. They start scheduling to have a cottage on this date or an Airbnb. And suddenly the Airbnbs get bought up. Suddenly the restaurants are getting full. And event tickets, seats are getting sold out at twice the rate of what can actually be consumed. And so the tickets get bid up in price. Now the seats are getting scarce at the concert, and people are paying a lot more for those tickets. Those tickets are getting really expensive. Airbnb prices go up because the whole market is getting sucked up, and people are like, there aren't any Airbnbs left with a pool. I'd really like to pay more for an Airbnb with a pool or an Airbnb with a driveway or one close to the beach. They're getting all bought up. So those prices increase. Restaurant, maybe they take on another waiter or two, waiter or waitress, and they're planning on having 50 people that night to eat. The parasailer or the guy making the gondola makes plans on, it's like, okay, we got 2 years. Can we make another gondola to go up this mountain so that we can fit more people up there for the view? Do I issue or charter a whole nother boat to have these people go out on this safari or get transported out to this island? Everybody's making all these huge plans. This is the boom period. Restaurants are hiring. Airbnbs are getting cleaned up and put on market. Prices are increasing. People are buying cottages just to flip them so that they can rent them out or sell them to some company that's then going to rent them out. People are doubling, musicians are doubling the amount of concerts they're doing. They're going to bigger venues. Everything's getting sold out. Everything looks like all this activity. Everything just could not be better than it is right now. It's a huge boom cycle. All the numbers look great. Prices look great. Investments look great. Everything looks amazing because look at all this consumption that's going to happen in the future because we all have the resources and we're all making these great plans to consume them later. That's the boom cycle. Then it comes time for the first person to get their consumption back, to get their resources back. I had a car. Now I need to use that car because our family has to get into this car and drive to the beach. And because they've rented an Airbnb. They get it. They take the car out of the bank. Then the next family. Then the next group. Then the next guy who's going on his little safari. Then the next woman who just needs time away to herself and wants to chill out in an Airbnb or go to a concert. And then the next person. And then suddenly, all the cars start to disappear. And the bank is now, people are coming now with tickets to the bank, and they don't have any cars left. The resources have disappeared. And now people are fighting there's people who really want to go on this vacation, and they're like, why now do I have to get two tickets just to get my car out? I thought this ticket was worth a car. And now you have people bidding up the prices just to try to get a car so that they can go on their vacation. And that's when people realize, I'm not going to be able to get a car. I have to cancel my reservation. I have to cancel this cottage. I'm going to have to pay the deposit on this stupid rental that I now can't afford. And they call up and they cancel their reservation. They go online as quick as they can when they realize they can't make the trip. Now they have to sell their ticket. And they think ticket prices are high. And in fact, a bunch of people were buying tickets. They were just scalping tickets because the price was going up so much during the boom period that this whole market for flipping rental property and scalping concert tickets and selling parking locations and all of this other information, all these other scarce resources just got bit up by speculators because it looked like there was all this stuff that needed to, there was this huge need in the market for to give all these things that were going to be consumed and or to provide all the things that were going to be consumed. So all these prices got bit up, and now they're like trying to sell their tickets, and the price tanks. Suddenly the ticket that they had to buy for, you know, $100, you know, the normal ticket's like $50, but then scalpers and all the people who were making the plans to go bid it up to $100, $150. And then they go on the market, and now there's a flood of people selling on the market because half of the people are having to cancel the plan. Half of the people are having to not go to the concert. So now there's a flood of new supply on the reselling market. And now the price, the ticket that was once $50 is now being desperately trying to throw at other people on the internet for $20. And the guy who was flipping rental properties is now sitting on two rentals and that were booked, and now they get canceled. And they put it back out on the market for someone else. And instead, the whole neighborhood worth of Airbnbs, they all get canceled. Same with, you know, the restaurant has to fire the waitress. The guy who was making a second gondola up to the mountain has to completely cancel his project halfway through because now there's nobody coming. Everybody just canceled all their reservations and all their plans. And all these pumped up prices and all these the jobs that got created, the people who started flipping houses, the people who started scalping tickets, suddenly all of them not only don't have just a stable market, they have a plummeting market. They have to adjust what they do as fast as humanly possible because they're screwed. They've consumed the next 10 years worth of business in the last three, and now there's no supply in the market left. And it's all because the bank was selling more car notes than cars that actually existed. And so that's when the bust comes. That's the important thing, is the bust is the most important part of the cycle. Because the bust is when people realize finally that the boom was fake, that we didn't have all the cars to actually do all of these trips, to make all these plans, to consume. It was this false sense of wealth that was just created on promises that couldn't be fulfilled. And it started with the bank. And what's crazy is the bank is the one that profited from all of this. And we're using the example of the bank as the one that is, this is the whole banking system. This is not like one bank doing this. This is the law. This is how finance is structured at its core. This is the Federal Reserve Bank and Federal Reserve System and what it causes in the economy. And it's actually doubly like worsened in its boom and bust cycle because they also manipulate the interest rate, which is the price of using resources. It's the price of time, essentially. That's what the interest rate is what does it cost for me to use resources today that I haven't produced yet? Like that's the interest rate. Like, so if the interest rate on debt is like 25%, that means that the price of saving for the future is pretty high. I should be saving for the future because the cost of trying to consume something today that I have not yet produced is really high. Like somebody else is having to produce on my behalf. And, you know, somebody else has to make the sandwiches that I'm consuming today. So that's what the interest rate is doing. And the fact that they can both essentially print the tickets that allow people to get a car out of the bank and then at the same time manipulate the price, the interest rate for borrowing those resources versus actually saving them, well, then they can manipulate both the price of time and they can manipulate how many resources it appears that we have available to us. So the imbalance is actually way worse in the real economy. It just gets covered up because they can spread out as far as the dollar is being used, like in all the economies and the petrodollar and all that stuff. They get to spread that cost out over all of the economies that use the dollar because the more cars that they have and the larger their pool of garaged resources is, the longer they can actually keep up the facade. As long as they keep the illusion going, things will continue to increase. People will continue to hire, you know, waiters and waitresses and plan for more people, more tourists, and all this kind of stuff. It's not until we reach that point where the real resources, the real underlying resources, just hit a tipping point and some sort of catalyst or some sort of event just basically triggers the sell-off and causes all the prices to come tumbling back down. And but that's what's critical, is the bust is the most important part of the cycle. The bust needs to happen. The bust should have happened 1 year in. We should not have prolonged the boom. It's only because they can manipulate the interest rate and they can manipulate how many cars that look to be available that they can keep this thing going. If there was a market price for the interest rate, if there was a market reserve, if there was actually a one-to-one ratio in the banking system or each individual note was based on what resources each individual bank had, if we had like a free banking system, you'd never be able to sustain it. Like it would just be like a fractional reserve in a Bitcoin exchange like Mt. Gox. Like, you know, it might last for 6 months until people just start trying to withdraw. But eventually the gig is up because people want the actual resources. It's only because it's systemic. It's only because it's law. It's only because the government forces you to use the dollar and then implements fractional reserve among every bank as a collective that you can actually keep it up on 10, 20-year time frames and cause these massive booms and massive busts that the economy would actually wipe out really fast because prices are actually able to adjust. That and, of course, the centralized authority or the dictating of what the interest rate is. But that's it in a nutshell. That's the boom-bust cycle, is everybody is planning to consume and they're looking at this pool of resources as if it's massive, as if we have 10 times as much wood and production of nails and all this stuff than we actually have. So they're planning and they start building all of these houses. We've got so many more cars available. You know, we had 100 million cars available when we really only have 20. We have, all this steel production and all of this consumption is going to happen because we have all this saved resources. And it's not true. It's an illusion. It's based on, and that's why it looks like it works. That's why Keynesianism appears to work when you look at it from a strictly data point of view, because they do these manipulations. They encourage people to go into debt and make all these plans. And for the next 5 years, everything looks wonderful. And they're like, look at this data. Every single time we do this, the economy gets better. And it's just this, it's just greed and animal spirits that cause the bust in 9 years when the whole gig is up. So if you don't look at it from a axiomatic in the sense of like, from what's happening with the real resources, if you continue to confuse it with all the numbers and all the statistics that make it look like something great is happening. If you just look at the boom numbers, you don't see why there's going to be a bust. You can't see what the imbalance actually is that's causing this massive swing in the economy. And the prices simply are not allowed to keep it in balance, which is what the price would normally do. If the price of money properly adjusted, if the interest rate, the price of capital across time was able to freely adjust, and if the price of notes for each individual bank, if we had something like a free banking system, you would simply never be able to sustain this type of thing. And in fact, that's why they got rid of the free banking system in the 1800s, and then in the early 1900s implemented the fractional reserve system, because it means that banks have to tighten their belt. They actually have to make decisions about a limited amount of resources. When they're like, it's just numbers on a spreadsheet, we could easily just issue a bunch of gold notes without having the gold. Wouldn't that be easier? Yeah, for them. But for everybody else, it's a disaster, because you're committing fraud. You're stealing resources from people by making them buy notes that aren't worth anything. You're inventing value that doesn't exist, and you're tricking people into buying it. It's fraudulent. Simple. This is simple as it gets. So hopefully, I kind of drew that one out a little bit longer than I had intended to. But hopefully that like spells the picture really well for anyone who has not heard that analogy before. And I particularly like that one. I think it's simple enough to really wrap your head around. And so I wanted to hit that for an episode today. And the next one that I'm still collecting some notes and arguments for is on deflation versus inflation, because we constantly get this argument that inflation is good for the economy. And it's part of the exact same reason why people think the dichotomy between inflation and deflation is actually similar to the whole idea of the boom and bust cycle, that look at the, as long as we just look at the boom, because that's kind of what's going on with inflation, or the boom is actually a process of watching inflation happen that's unsustainable based, like price inflation. Obviously we have to have inflation, right, to encourage people to spend resources, to spend money, to consume. But we will shed some light on that in its own episode sometime in the future when I get all my thoughts together on it. And that will be in a deflation versus inflation. Which one gives a healthy economy and which one makes a sustainable economy? So with that, thank you guys for listening to this Guy's Take episode. I am Guy Swan, your host, and this is the Crypto Economy Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, or somebody else is telling you that the boom and bust cycle is caused by free markets and you want to direct them to an explanation of why that is nonsense, maybe this one will do you some good. Maybe you can share this one out. And anybody in the crypto space who wants to learn more about economics, wants to learn more about Bitcoin, the technology, wants to hear all the best articles read aloud and expounded on and discussed, send them here. Send them to the Crypto Economy Podcast. Send them to Guy Swan. I will be here almost every day talking and reading about all of this great stuff. So you can also support the show by going to anchor.fm and becoming a supporting listener. That's a huge, huge way to help the show. And I thank you to the couple of supporters that I already have. That's an amazing help and it makes me really happy. And also, of course, you can just share this out. Or you can donate Bitcoin. You got somebody donated with Breeze Wallet. David did. David Parrish. Thank you for that donation. I haven't even checked it out yet, but that's awesome that you actually got to play with the Breeze Wallet. I'm still waiting for it on iOS because my Android is old and not powerful enough to actually do anything anymore. So I'm excited. I'm waiting for that. But yeah, you can tip me with Lightning, the tipping.me jar, or a Bitcoin address that I have on cryptoeconomy.life. Thank you guys so much. And until next time, this is the Crypto Economy Podcast. I am Guy Swan signing out. Take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.